Session number 10601, Rule 5.
Mr. Cottier, Reel 5. I'd like to ask you one last thing about the role of regimental policemen. It's really your opinion about the punishments that were given to the men. What did you think about those? Did you think they were dealt with fairly?
Yes, very fairly. Because, in the first place, when you charged a man, the charge had to be made out on what you call a 252. Any soldier will laugh if you mention the word 252. It's a charge sheet. On there you put the soldier's number, rank and name and the offence committed, date and time. And he paid, first of all, before his company commander, who was a major. Now then, if his company commander thought that the charge was sufficient to warrant punishment by the colonel, then he would remand him to be tried by the commanding officer. But if he thought he could deal with it, then the company commander himself would deal out the punishment.
You'd be in a position where you'd see these company commanders in this situation, wouldn't you?
Yes, well, you see, first of all, when you charged a man, he automatically went to his company commander, and you went in with the man, you marched in. The company commander read off the charge sheet. Private Smith, at walking on such and a date, you hereby charged with being improperly dressed. You see? Then you see a policeman give your evidence. Then I would give my evidence. You see? And then you'd say to the accused, have you got anything to say? Probably did, probably didn't. Probably guilty, or he'd have an explanation. And of course, according to that, the company commander would assess what punishment he could give him. Or, on the other hand, he might say, well, I can't deal with this. It's got to go to the commanding officer, which is Lieutenant Colonel, command the battalion. So the same performance was repeated again. You went in, you give your evidence, then the commanding officer would say, this is very tricky, he would say, will you accept my punishment or be tried by field general court martial? Well, 9 times out of 10, the man would say, I'll accept your punishment, sir, because he did want a field court martial. And of course, the colonel went fully into the evidence. He cross-questioned the policeman, and bearing in mind that we used to have our facts, because we were cut out too many times. Experience told you to have your facts right. And of course, also ended up in getting punishment. But I think they were dealt with very fairly. The colonel listened patiently, and he balanced the situation. And I don't think anybody was ever dealt with severely, unjustly.
Were the company commanders consistent, in your opinion, in the way that they handed out punishment? Between one another, so that if it was the same offence taken before one company commander, they would, all of them would have in fact dealt with it in the same way.
Yes, more or less. I think it became a pattern. They didn't have any set thing, but I think it became like a sort of a general pattern. If it was just improperly dressed, the company commander would award him 3 DCB, you see. But if it was drunkenness, you know, then he had to go before the colonel. No, the company can't just do the petty things, you know, like improperly dressed, or maybe a few minutes late coming in, you see. And most cases, they dealt with them, because they didn't want to bungle the colonel. Remember, you've got 5 companies, and if those 5 company commanders push the load onto the colonel, he's going to have a busy day. So they tried to equalise that by dealing with the situation themselves. But there was cases where they couldn't. They had to go to the colonel.
You mentioned in passing that the CO would give the prisoner an option of being sentenced by him or going to a higher court-martial. Did any prisoners take that option and ask for a court-martial?
There's only one occasion I remember, and that was myself. I opted for court-martial. But that was later on, during the war.
At what time was this? What year was this?
This was about 1942, just a few weeks prior to going out to the Far East.
Could you tell me the circumstances of this incident?
Well, we had just moved down to a place called Cheltenham. And that particular time, I was provost sergeant, and I had 8 men undergoing detention, and I had 4 men pending court martial. And when we arrived in Cheltenham at our new quarters, which was Nessenhuts, I was given this Nessenhut to house these men. And when I got a look round, to me, it wasn't satisfactory. It wasn't secure enough. A Nessenhut, if you can imagine, a door at each end, windows at each end, no bars on the windows, and of course, during the war, the provost sergeant handed the prisoners over to the guard, which meant the sentry stood outside the door. You see, after 6 o'clock at night, he handed the prisoners over to the guard, and the sentry stood outside the door. Now, this sentry was alone during the night, quite a long distance from his colleagues in the guard room, somewhere about 150 yards. And that man could have been easily overpowered. The thing was, the structure of the guard room itself wasn't secure. Now, I made this known to the RSM. I made a verbal complaint stating that I couldn't possibly take responsibility for the security, but I was bypassed. Later on, behold, a prisoner did escape, a man by the name of Staveley. It was on a Sunday afternoon, and I, being very lenient with my staff, I let them have the afternoon off because we didn't do any detention work or defaulter work on a Sunday. And I stayed behind in this Nessenhut looking after the prisoners. And I had a little office partitioned off, and I fell asleep. And when I fell asleep, one of these prisoners had gone through the window. See? So, naturally, I had to report it to the adjutant, and of course, the adjutant forewarned me to cease offence, and I was placed on the charge. And that time, it was Colonel Stobart. And I went before the colonel on a charge. The RSM gave the evidence, permitting the prisoner to escape on such an idiot, blah, 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 blah. And of course, the colonel asked me if I would accept his punishment or be tried by field general court-martial. And much to the shock of everybody, the colonel, the RSM and the adjutant, much to their surprise, they were shocked when I said I'd accept to be tried by a field general court-martial.
Why did you do that?
Well, because I was right in the first place. The guard room was insecure, and my advice had been overlooked. And I didn't think it was fair to hold me responsible for those prisoners under those circumstances. Now then, bear in mind, when I said that I accepted to be tried by a field general court martial, we then had been issued with our tropical kit and were expected to go abroad any day. And I had already arranged to be married before going abroad. But I was still prepared to take the court-martial. Now then, I knew that if I took the court-martial, the battalion would go away and leave us because they couldn't take me with them. I'd have to be left in the UK. No, I didn't want that. I wanted to go with my battalion. But I was prepared to forfeit that. And again, I arranged to get married. Now then, the colonel probably thought, this guy is trying to get out, going abroad. That's why he's accepting the court-martial. But I reminded the colonel. I said, sir, I says, about 3 weeks ago, I said, I was in this office and you asked me if I wanted to be released from the army to go back in the mines. And I said, no. I want to go abroad with the battalion. Because then there was a circular to all units requesting any miner who wished to leave the forces, go back into the mines, could do so. And I was one of them. Now, I was the only one who turned that offer down. There were several who took it. But I told the council, no, to stay with the battalion and go abroad. Now, that overruled that. So, right on, he says, consider yourself on house arrest, which meant I couldn't go to town. I relinquished my duties. I didn't have an escort, being a provost sergeant, didn't give me an escort. I just went about the camp. Then I was sent for by the adjutant to ask who I required to defend an officer. Why, a soldier who takes a court-martial can ask for any officer in the army to defend him. That's his privilege. I told him I would defend myself. But I would like a consultation with the garrison engineer, who was a Royal Engineers officer in town in Cheltenham. This was granted, and I explained the case to the garrison engineer. He came and examined the Nesson Hut, and as he said, it was inadequate. It's just impossible to hold prisoners. Next day I was sent for, and the case was squashed.
Can you tell me the procedures that went on in the court-martial?
I didn't reach the court-martial.
Uh-huh.
You see, the case was squashed. You see, what happens when a man goes to a court-martial, the colonel is responsible for sending a complete report to the brigadier. Then the brigadier again authorises the court-martial to take place. But mine had never reached that stage because I had requested a consultation with a garrison engineer, you see, and I was going to use him as a witness. But apparently he must have gone back to the colonel and told him he was flogging a dead horse if I took him as witness. And on those grounds, the case was squashed.
Was anything ever said to you about that?
No, there were no malice, no nothing. I went about my duties. Of course, there always had been a bit of trouble between myself and the RSM. That particular RSM. During my service, I served under five RSMs, but this particular one, we never got on at all. And that was why, in the first place, he didn't take any notice of my advice. In the second place, well, he had the charges on the prisoners, because he had no alternative. There was a stigma between him and I for the rest of our service, but of course, luckily, he didn't stay with us very long. He left.
Okay, well perhaps we can look at the greater details of your career in 1942 later on when we come to 1942. For the moment now, I'd like to return back to Woking and to the barracks themselves. Mm. Could you tell me a little bit about the barracks? Were they greatly different from the ones at Fenham?
Well, I would think they'd be built about the same time as Fenham barracks, judging by the structure. But previous to them being barracks, It had been a woman's prison. And of course, the War Ministry took them over and named them Inkerman Barracks, Woking Barracks. And that's how it comes that we had the proper cells, because it had been a woman's prison. Of course, the barrack blocks themselves had been converted, made into barrack rooms, but the structure themselves was somewhat similar to Fenner barracks. They'd hold about 700 soldiers, troops. I suppose the same about prisoners, I suppose. It was situated about 2 miles from Woking itself, in rather nice residential area. Just outside the barracks, you had the officers' quarters.
Did it have a large parade ground in there?
Yes. You had the officers' quarters, which was nicely spaced out, houses, you know, nicely spaced out, lawns and everything. And, of course, you had the church opposite, which was part of the barracks. It had been part of the prison. Then, of course, built onto that, there'd been the married quarters for NCOs and warrant officers. The barrack square was fairly large. It would be about 300 yards by about 200 tarmac adam. And, of course, a very impressive entrance, the archway with the iron gates.
Yes, you mentioned those in connection with another story. Were there high walls around these?
Yes, there were 14-foot walls all the way around. The only thing which had been added to the barracks, as far as I can remember, was the canteen. That was a different nature stone, different style of building. Of course, I don't suppose they have a canteen in there, went to the women's prison. And that was the only different structure to the barracks themselves. But it was typically looked like prison.
And can you tell me a little bit about your own quarters, your accommodation? You mentioned the guard room several times. What sort of accommodation did you have there?
Well, as you entered the archway, on your left-hand side, you had the small office reception place. Then you went along the corridor, and there was a police quarters, which held about 12 beds. Opposite that, there's what we call the loose box. It had about 4 beds in. You get more in, like. Then further along the...
That's where you put prisoners, the loose box?
Yes, the loose box, the drunks. Then further along the corridor was the 3 cells. Now, these 3 cells would be 10 foot by 6, as opposed to the loose box, which is 10 foot by 18.
Was that surrounded by wire of some sort, or was it a proper room with lockable doors?
Oh, yes. The cells were constructed in the same manner as a prison. Thick doors, which could only be locked from the outside. The doors had a peephole in, and the cell itself was bare. There was no toilet. There was no heating. And you had the bars, typical cell. The beds were made of wood, and they were only about 6 inches off the floor. You see? And you had a block, a wooden block, for a pillow. This was attached to the bed itself. 3 boards put it together. Now, these beds were only 6 inches from the floor, and at the head of the bed, it was hinged to the floor, so you could lift the bed back during the daytime up against the wall. Now, we never did that in the 3 cells, because all day long those beds were down, because the soldier had to lay his kit at Rivali on the bed every day, and that kit stopped there until 7 o'clock at night. But in the loose box, where they didn't lay kit, because it was just for drunks and what have you, Those beds were put back to make more space, you see. They were hinged to the floor. And sometimes when you put drunks in, they would go around knocking the beds down like dominoes to create a noise, you know. Our quarters were all right, very spacious. And the windows looked out onto the main road. The floor was polished. Two tables, scrubbed lily white. Four forms, get your meals off. Because our meals was brought to us from the cookhouse in containers. We weren't supposed to eat with the rest of the battalion. Normally fireplace. And that was the only heating there was in that building, in our quarters. And of course, you had your normal locker, and then you had your big locker for your civilians and your blue patrols. Accommodation's good. Army standard, good.
Were you responsible for keeping it clean, or did you...
Well, the prisoners and the defaulters did all that. But of course, never was a time, but had there been a time when they had no prisoners or defaulters, then we would have just kept it clean, because we would have had time on our hands. We wouldn't have had prisoners or defaulters to look after. But since we did have, every day those tables and forms were scrubbed, and four or five times a day the floor was polished, and we didn't do any, we just supervised it, you know, and the prisoners or the defaulters got so used to it, they knew exactly what had to be done. They knew where the brushes were, the polish was, and just went about the daily chores, scrubbing and polishing. They knew exactly what had to be done. That's another thing we didn't have to do, you see. We didn't have any barrack room chores.
Was the food any different at all, would you say, from what it had been at Farnham?
No, much similar. Good food, solid, well cooked, plenty of it. But there was no difference, really. I would think that it was just passed on from one cook to another, you know. Basic army food.
Was the feedback that you'd given to the regimental cooks at Farnham, I remember you talking about some particular food that you liked. It was
study cake.
That's right, yeah. Was that taken on board here?
Yes, you had your company mess meetings. Each company held its own mess meeting. You see, then that five mess meetings, you had five companies, you had five mess meetings. The ideas were pooled into one. Then it was taken before the catering officer and the cook sergeant, something similar. You know, change of menu, change of food. But it all came down to the same thing eventually.
Okay, can I ask you about training? Clearly, as a regimental policeman, you didn't do many of the ordinary duties that the other soldiers would be doing. But did you receive any special training of any sort?
No. We didn't get any training as policemen. We just followed the sort of code of conduct which was handed down from the provost sergeant, which in turn he had gained from previous courses. You just handed down verbally, and you followed their example.
What was this code of conduct?
Dealing with prisoners in general, you know, supervising of prisoners. The only training we got was for the motorbike and driving a 1500-weight truck.
You mentioned this code of conduct. You said dealing with prisoners. What sort of specific things were you recommended or told to actually do in dealing with prisoners?
Well, address them firmly, precisely. Stand a reasonable distance from them. And of course, conduct yourself in a military manner.
Were you told how to deal with people who were trying to provoke you into some sort of action?
Oh, yes. Well, you did get that, you see. Sometimes you would see a prisoner lagging behind, you know, just being lackadaisical, and you just give him a sharp reminder that he wasn't going fast enough, and you compared his work with someone else's, you know. But as for being provoked, it was never much attempted, because they knew that we had the whip hand, as you might say, and they knew that we could make it difficult for them. They knew that we could take them before the colonel and probably lose their remission or get PD, punishment diet. So it really didn't arise, except, I say, you may get a prisoner who's a little bit fed up and sick and being lackadaisical, and you just give him a quick reminder, clip of the tongue sort of thing, and that he wasn't pulling his weight.
Yes, I was thinking of what you might have been told in terms of how to deal with these things, as opposed to what actually happened. Like you've already given me the instances of to speak firmly, to stand a reasonable distance away from
yes, that's all there was to it, really. Just like a foreman stands supervising, you know. I found that the least you spoke, the better. Things worked out better that way, because by bullying and shouting, you got involved, become excited, and you got out of control. I took a tip from Maguire. He said, keep quiet and solemn, you know.
Did some of your colleagues not take that tip?
Yes, as some used to get themselves aerated over nothing, you know, and frustrated. And all the time, I suppose, the bloke would be laughing, you know. But I send an example off Maguire's pattern, you see. Just be very quiet about nature about it. The only time you did any bowling shouting was when you had them on parade, you know, pack parade, but this didn't occur at peacetime. We didn't take them on pack parade in peacetime, just in wartime.
Right. You mentioned that you were taught how to drive a van and ride a bike. Can you tell me about these two aspects of your training?
Well, after I'd been on the police for a few months, I was assigned to a motorcycle. It was down in my name, and I was responsible for it. It was a BSC, a twin-cylinder, 500cc. And, of course, for me to use that bike, I had to make up what you call a work ticket and take it down to the MTO. He would sign it, authorised me to use that bike and authorised me to fill up with petrol. The training we got, first of all, it wasn't very intensive, and it really was done on a Sunday morning on the barrack square, when the barrack square wasn't in any use. We'd ride up and down the barrack square on a Sunday morning, you know, start, stop and turn in, because we had plenty of room to manoeuvre, as opposed to being outside on the roads. And then if we did come off the bike, then we're on WD property. We weren't on civilian property, sort of thing. So you got two or three Sunday mornings riding up and down the barrack square until they thought you were sufficient, good enough to start and stop it at least.
How many people were responsible for your training?
Tom, Dick and Harry. You know, anybody who was available on the police section, you see?
I see.